The discourse that is not helping us is one that has arisen that equates being mentally healthy with feeling good or calm mm-hmm. or relaxed. And there is no psychologist in the world who would go for that definition. And so this book, it has two sort of main thrusts. One is to like recenter our definition. And the definition that I advance throughout the book is mental health is not about feeling good.
Hi, y'all. Here's what's so interesting is that this is a brand new podcast, and it is Parenting Teens Unfiltered with Kat and Nat. And we are, you know, we are releasing experts that you need to hear from our own perspective of parents, because shit, parenting is hard. But we have this newsletter called The Cap, and it is sort of like a roundup of what's going on in the world of parenting. And it's really interesting, and
it's one of those things where you've seen probably the story come up on social media or in the news, but you didn't have time to read it and you thought it was important, but you didn't get to it. We go and find those topics, dive deep into them and do the work for you, and then just give it to you nice and short, so you know what's going on in the world.
And my mom brought it up at like one of our Easter dinners, mm-hmm. and she was like, it's so interesting. She's like, I read it in your newsletter.
Yes.
And then she's like, everyone needs to subscribe to that. Are you subscribed? She basically went around them. Are you? And I was like, thank you, Mom.
Yes.
And then it happened tonight yesterday.
Yes. My husband, we were out and he brought up a particular topic and was telling us statistics on this. And at the time, I don't know if I was really listening to like what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And then the next day, bam, he gets the newsletter and he's like, this is exactly what I was talking about.
You're welcome.
And it's that kids are missing way more school than we actually think.
No, my kids are missing so much school.
But what's the
reason?
Not the reason. I know the reason. What's the outcome? What's the is there a problem?
I'll tell you my problem in it.
Well, I'm just seeing if the thing is, it's yes. Yeah. It's a lot too. We got used to having them around.
No. And also they missed. My kids dropped out in grade 5. They did not finish grade 5 or like grade 5, grade 3, whatever. They did not go to their grades. And then the following year, she did. But in grade 5, she basically stopped in December and missed all of December all the way through to September and caught up and was they preached in our heads.
Yeah.
You can miss this amount of time. Yes. And it was okay.
Yes.
So it's kind of like,
it's actually like, so it's, they're missing more school 15%, more than before the pandemic. And it's this relaxed attendance because it's like, you're starting to realize
what's like, what is for me, it's like, really, you need to go there. And when I see other schools doing school in such a shorter amount of time,
yeah,
I'm kind of like, I get it. It's just,
as from a parenting perspective, does it teach them?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Okay.
I think it teaches, I'm getting nervous that I'm not putting enough emphasis on, I'm
the responsibility to attend.
I feel like they think it's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And my one...
unfortunately, then they get their marks and it isn't no big deal.
So my
no
older
deal.
One, no problem.
Yeah.
Hers are medical appointments. Mm-hmm. She misses probably four afternoons. She misses so much school, but she's still getting... She catches up. She does homework. It's important to her to be a straight A student. The little one is right now... Like, she's in grade 3, but she's like locked and loaded and is... you know, a really strong reader and not that strong in math, but strong reader. And so I feel like that's a good foundation for if you're going to miss school. And then that other one, I just feel like, oh, I got to dial them back in again because I have been like...
I feel like the only one I can be lax with is the little one, even though, you know, he's behind in some areas, but because he's so young, I'm like, it doesn't really matter. Like he'll catch up when he went. But the other ones, I actually try to not. It stresses me out when they miss school.
Cause, and I'm like, yeah, don't worry about it. Oh yeah, you want to go to the Jays game? Yeah, for sure. Oh, you want to go to? Yeah, for sure. Him, I'm just gonna. So
I feel nervous that if they miss too much school, then they're gonna be
absolutely
left behind.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What do you guys think?
No, absolutely. It's bad. I was thinking, I'm like, I don't do parent-teacher interviews. I'm going tonight. So he knows I'm getting back serious again.
Oh,
But I have to, it's routine. That's all it is. It's knowing that you can't just bounce out when you don't like something. So true. That's all it is. It's
because work is going to be non-negotiable.
Yep. So I'm having a little blip. I'm going to get back on it again. Like he basically is like, I joked with him today. I'm like, so I'll pick you up at 12. He's like, seriously? I'm like, no, I was joking with you, but I've got a, because we're going on a trip. He's not going on school trips.
I know.
The whole fucking thing is a disaster. I'm like, no, I've got to. Okay.
But recommit. We don't have any emails or calls, right?
I mean, I emailed all of them being like, are we okay? I really was nervous we weren't okay. So I'm just checking in to make sure we're okay.
Can you go see my kids' teachers for me too?
Yeah, yours is fine. You know yours is fine. Yeah. He's fine.
And he would like us to go to parent teacher. But yesterday, my husband and I were like,
why? Well, I don't even care what you're doing. Just are we okay? Like, I don't even care about the marks. I'm like, are we just like, when he's here, is he here?
Yeah.
Like, are we actually, because you can't turn, there's one thing to like not be there. Mm. It's another thing to not think school
is important at
because
all.
Because that's kind of where I feel like we're going.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, yeah, 26% of public school students were chronically absent this past year.
I'm not surprised. Because I am part of the problem, and I think the parents are too. Mm-hmm. I think it's all the parents. Mm-hmm. And I think we're just like, also, I think we're tired. I think parents are tired. We parented so hard for so many years with COVID. And I just feel like, I'm like, oh my God, we're still doing this.
I think we also have more of like PTSD from illnesses and spreading illnesses. Oh, yeah,
and you can't go out and you can't, I mean, they're always sick right now. I mean, she's been off for 2 weeks at one. And she was really sick though. Like I finally got her medication.
She's also really young.
Yeah.
That one we don't have to worry about.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true. Right. Is that all the topic was?
Well, yeah, but we don't have a podcast to go with it.
Yeah, we do. It's coming. We're just going to throw to it. Basically, you guys get like a little roundup of what we're talking about. Because
have we done the podcast?
Yeah.
About missing school?
Yeah. So Lisa DeMore, if it's the one that we're releasing, Lisa, in The Common Parent, there's one with Lisa DeMore where she was talking about kind of how kids are definitely what to do when your kid doesn't want to go to school, when they're absent, yes, and when they're skipping it. And like, you know, you remember that?
Yeah.
And
yes.
And it's just kind of like it's so hard, especially when your kids get older, when they miss the boat of going regularly, because then they feel so behind. They're like, what's the point? I also think this is a massive problem. I think that we have put the standard of achieving so high that if you're getting 50s and 60s and you know you can't get into university, college, because your grades aren't good enough, what's the point of going?
Mm.
Like, if you can't get in, why the hell am I going? I that was me. I felt that way. If I'm getting 50, if I can't pass and all you need are like straight A's to get in, what's the point of this?
Yeah, that's what I did too.
I'm like, really? I think
now I look back and I'm like, I could probably could have learned something there about something. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've done all right, but
I feel like they put so much pressure on you to get a good grade to get into if you don't have this. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's not just an us thing. I've been talking to a lot of moms who say they don't even know where this pressure is coming from, where they begin to have to know what they're doing, what they want to do, what their grades are. And then all the stories in the news are like, this kid had a volunteer and they did this and 100% average and they didn't get into the school they wanted. And I'm like, what? I get why kids are like, if there's a 2% like acceptance rate, what the fuck is the point?
Well, I do know, but because I have had worked with guidance counselors this year, there are lots of places where you don't need, like that's to go to specific schools.
Right, but that's all you hear. Mm. So if you're not talking to your teen actively, yes, being like, listen, there's lots of options.
Yeah.
I mean, as a parent, I don't know what those places are.
I didn't either. So and then I saw what marks you had to get to go to like places that everybody goes to. I'm like, oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
That'll be fine.
So you think in your head you have to have above 90.
I even thought you had to be so smart
to get into anything.
To get into anywhere or else you weren't going to get into anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like,
we have to talk to our kids about that.
And I think that's really the lesson before we hear from Lisa, like from my experience. And even when I worked with some of the hardest youth who just were not going to go to school, let alone even try to get a grade, was like, what do you want? What does that look like to get there?
Work back.
Mm-hmm. And if they're like, I don't care, then you're like, you can't make them care.
Mm-mm.
So whether they take alternative school, whether they take breaks, whether they go to work, the best thing I did was go to work. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, this is way harder than school.
Mm.
Holy shit. Mm. This is it. It's kind of, that's it. they go to school, they work full time. You're mm-hmm. like this.
I kind of like preferred work because I could, at least I came out with something and it was money.
It just wasn't fun.
No, it wasn't fun.
Like my friends were at dinner at 3 o'clock having fun. Mm-hmm. I'm working 8 hours with mm-hmm. a 30 minute break.
But you got money.
Yeah, but I had to pay for rent. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't have free money. Mm-hmm. Wasn't like I was like, I'm going on trips. Mm-hmm. So sometimes them taking a break isn't as long as they're not just playing video games. Like mm-hmm. if you can hold them accountable to do something, I don't think it's terrible. Anyways, guys.
Let's hear from the expert.
Good luck. If you're not a member of The Common Parent, make sure you go check it out. It is some of the most valuable money you can honestly invest into your relationship with your teen and tween and learn communication skills and let alone a whole bunch of skills that are applied to life, not just tween and teen, which I've come to learn.
Because relationships are relationships.
No matter what the age, what the size.
Whenever we get on with you, it's like we're like so crazy all over the place. And then you always just promise. It's like, oh, we're with Lisa now. Everyone just relax.
I'm so happy to be with you. I'm so in love with you guys. Well, I want you to know, like, you should know this. Like, your generosity and your support, your unalloyed, just awesome womanness, like, has really been inspirational to me to be as absolutely generous and supportive as I can possibly be from the position in which I sit. And I just want you to know that, like, not only are you doing so much good, but I think you're pushing the industry standard. And I just want you to know that.
Oh my gosh. That's the strangest thing. Thank you for saying that. And just telling you, you're my plane book. You're my audio book when I'm on the plane and I've been listening to you. And it's like, you know, I think often when you're a writer or you're in the space, you don't know how many people you help, and you also are touching people so widely and deeply. And
thank you.
You know, it is a space where we're all confused and you make it less confusing. So thank you. Really,
and
truly.
Like it says in your bio, you are a thought leader. Like things that you say really makes you stop and think.
I appreciate that. And you guys got the new book that comes out?
I have the new book. Okay. I am not listening to, I'm going through the audio book. I'm kind of going through all of them because I am obsessed right now with parenting failure, like failure in children and resiliency and mm-hmm. you know how everything's connected. And yeah. you know, your new book is like, honey. I know she's just, my dog's here in love with me. The emotional lives of teenagers, feel like, you know, as we're living it, people haven't been talking about it because it's not our story to talk about. So it feels so confusing when your child is coming home with emotions and feelings that you think they should be able to handle because the expectation is so high. And, you know, I have my son's in a very high level of sports. Mm. And the coaches act fireable. If they were at a job, they would be fired.
Yep.
But then these kids leave there and come to us. And I think, how can we expect to be all? And I think of teachers and people in these teenagers' lives who treat them disrespectfully just for looking like a teenager.
Yep.
And
they're sometimes the most influential people in their lives.
And they're supposed to just be, they're supposed to come home and be. I'm perfect, but you guys can act crazy, but me, no. So, I mean, why was this new book written? Like, what was your inspiration on it?
So, I, you know, the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
And I've always worked on the topic of adolescence. And my work shifted so dramatically to suddenly just trying to help in any way I possibly could to help parents help their teenagers stay afloat through it. I mean, it was really... You know, I mean, the pandemic was horrible for everyone. It hit teenagers in a very particular way. I know where you are. I mean, I care for a lot of, you know, communities around you. The lockdowns went on for so long and were so hard. And so there were two things that happened at once. One was a crisis for teenagers. I mean, an absolute mental health crisis for teenagers that just dropped on everybody. And then the other actually was... I think a problematic discourse that came up around mental health, that we started talking about it in a way as a culture that is not accurate and actually not helpful. And so I sort of felt like, okay, I wasn't planning to write another book, but I have to like do my part. And the discourse that is not helping us is one that has arisen that equates being mentally healthy with feeling good or calm mm-hmm. or relaxed. And there is no psychologist in the world who would go for that definition. And so this book, it has two sort of main thrusts. One is to like recenter our definition. And the definition that I advance throughout the book is mental health is not about feeling good. It's about having feelings that make sense in their context, right? So if a coach says something awful to your kid and your kid is hurt and mad, that is evidence of your kid's mental health, right? It may be really uncomfortable and really unpleasant, but we would expect and actually want to see that. And then the second part is handling emotions effectively, right? So what happens to that upset, mad feeling, right? Does your kid go smoke a ton of weed to deal with it? Or do they come home and talk to you about it, right? So really trying to change that definition. And then the other thing I try to do in the book, the last two chapters, there's five chapters, are I call them actual playbooks for handling your kid's emotion. And chapter four is the playbook for helping your kid handle emotions. We call it regulate emotions, you know, technically, by expressing what they're feeling. And chapter five is about helping kids regulate emotions by bringing them back under control. And that was another sort of cultural thing that had happened where we really, whatever it's reminded me of. So when I was like hugely pregnant with my daughter, who's now in college, so it was like 20 years ago, I was with a senior colleague and we were wrapping up some work. And she said, this is my oldest, my first kid. And she said, so do you want to hear how psychologists mess up their kids? And I was like, yes, because I have seen those kids. I've seen those kids. And she said, they talk about feelings too much, that the point comes where it's sometimes helpful to say to a kid, all right, you've been upset for a long time. We're talking, it's not helping. Like, what would help you feel better? And so the other thing I try to do, besides trying to like recenter a useful definition and actually an accurate definition of mental health, the other thing I aim to do in this book is to put for parents on equal footing, helping kids express their emotions and helping kids rein those in, find comforts, bring them back under control. Because I sort of feel like we as a culture have like all become the psychologist parent, right? Who's like, I'm just going to talk this thing to death, which has its hazards. And so I really wanted parents to have a two-part repertoire for helping their kids.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. And I think that we're fearful of the feelings, right? So it's easier for us to have the conversations with them because then we're like, now you won't get depressed. Now you won't get anxiety. Now, but they need to feel the feelings, but we don't want them to. And if we talk them out of them, then it's like, okay, now we're afloat now. We're good. Let's carry on, you know?
Yeah. What's going to happen when we're not beside them? How are they going to handle it?
Absolutely. And the feelings, like this is the piece that is so how far we got departed from how we understand things in psychology. Psychologists are fine with negative feelings. Like we have no problem. In fact, they are like orient us to our worlds. They are often growth giving, right? They help us build empathy. And so our reflex as a culture is like, oh my God, our kid's in pain. Like I have to make it stop. Whereas the reflex I would love for us to have is, okay, my kid's in pain. Is this interesting? Does it map meaningfully onto what's occurred? Is it evidence that my kid actually works perfectly? And then the question is, how's it going to get handled? Is it going to get handled in a way that like brings relief and does no harm? Or is it going to get handled in a way that brings relief and does a ton of harm, right? So that's where I want parents' attention, not on whether or not their kid's in pain. Your teenager's going to be in pain. Like that's a done deal. Really looking at how they manage it. And that's why so much of the book is around a repertoire for managing emotions.
When we say, you know, I think as parents, where we get it is because people don't talk about it, it's like, when is it a problem? Like, when are we too sad? When are we too mad? When are we not feeling? So how are we gauging that, like checking in? Because, you know, there is a lot of, especially with Twitch that just came about and the whole thing was he was happy, he was fine. And, you know, and then we don't know the whole story. We're just that social media for you. How are we getting them to know when they need to ask for help if they're not willing to? What does that look like as a parent when you're like, do we need help here?
Well, exactly. And I actually think you just said the thing that is so often unspoken underneath this, which is like, my kid's really, really upset. Might they kill themselves? Like, I think that is underneath it for a lot of parents, and people are scared to say it. And I'm just glad you put it on the table. So let me first answer the when to worry about your kid generally. And then let me first offer just some ways for parents to calm their anxieties about suicide. Because I think it's such a tension in the media of both wanting to call attention to adolescent suicide. But I think it also has another effect of like really raising parents' anxieties in ways that like they don't always know what to do with that elevated anxiety.
Rescue the children and overcompensate is often.
That's
off. Which is true.
And of course, but if you feel like your kid's life is on the line, like what else are you going to do, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So let's separate these out. One is like general when to worry, and then let's hit suicide very directly.
Yes.
So the general when to worry. One is we expect teens' moods to be all over the map. So if your kid is like upset and then, you know, upset and then super happy and then upset and then super happy, you're exhausted, they're exhausted, they're developing normally. Like that is totally typical. We worry when they get stuck in a rut, right? So we worry when a kid is upset and they stay upset and stay upset and the things that they're trying to do don't help. That's when we think about depression. That's when we go get help. Also for teenagers, and this is key, depression can look like irritability. This is very unique to adolescents, but a depressed teenager can feel like you're living with a porcupine. Like they are just like everybody bothers them. Everybody rubs them the wrong way. They can't stand their friends. They can't stand their teachers. They can't stand their parents. That's not what we would expect to see. Like that's not just like a, you know, typical teenager. That's a worrisome teenager. So we worry about persistent or getting in the way of daily functioning mood or anxiety concerns. So that's a time to worry. Another time to worry, and this is to bring it back into the framework I'm pushing forward in this book, are they expressing feelings in a way that does harm? So it's not the feeling, but are they like angry, but then they're like taking it out on everybody else and being a total jerk about things? Or are they angry and they're harming themselves as a way to like express that aggression? And so they're the ones getting hurt. So it's not, again, it's not the feeling. It's how it's getting expressed and the fact that the expression is doing damage. Okay, if we go to the other side of it, like bringing feelings under control. Are they sad? Maybe somebody broke their heart. And so they're smoking tons of weed to deal with the sadness, right? That will bring the sadness under control. Huge price tag, right? So again, it's when they are using coping, and honestly, cutting is coping, smoking weed is coping, that is costly. That's when we worry. So either they can't function or their coping is costly. That's when to worry.
I mean, that is the key word. Coping is costly.
Yep.
And that is not that. I think if you can put that into your box, then you know right away that we're not dealing with this in a healthy matter. And when you think of it that way, that's a really easy tagline for parents to remember.
Good. I just came up with it. So let's stick with it. Okay.
Coping is costly.
Coping is costly.
Yeah. Right.
If it when to worry.
Cost, it's not probably the right way they should be coping.
Right. Like weed works. Like that's the problem with it, right? But it causes all these other problems. Okay. The question of suicide. So first of all, I think one thing that is helpful, and it's very hard to say this without seeming somehow dismissive of someone's pain, and I don't want to in any way indicate that that's the story. When we look at the statistics on suicide, which we do, teenagers are less likely to die by suicide than every older age group. Which is often comes as a surprise to families.
Yeah.
Because for reasons that I'm sure make tons of sense, we focus very heavily in the media on adolescent suicide. And I think I just want to put that out there just as a framework. And of course, like, no, any suicide is horrible. Like one suicide is too many suicides, right? And there's, you can't like measure suffering against suffering, but I just, one, in the deluge of new information, which is, it's so important that we focus on it. I also think that contextual piece is useful. That I think just because parents' anxieties are so high. Okay. But that doesn't matter if you're worried about your kid, right? Like that, like your kid is really what you're worried about. So here's what I want parents to know. Number one, you can ask your kid. And here's what I would say. I'm going to tell you how to do it and I'll tell you how not to do it because I hear from teenagers how not to do it. So if your kid is like deeply distressed or just has you freaked out, right? Like that's the experience as a parent. Like I am scared for my kid. You can say something like, you are really upset and I have to ask you a question. And this may feel like it's totally out of the blue or totally weird, but I just got to ask because I just got to ask, are you having any thoughts of harming yourself or taking your life? And here's what we know. Asking a kid that question will not make them suicidal. And this is often why parents don't ask, right? They think like, I don't want to put the idea in their head. Okay. You can't do that. right? The culture has already done it. I hate to say it, like it's all around us. But we also know that if a kid is suicidal, they actually feel better when they are asked. They are glad to be asked. So you can ask this question. All right, so that's how I would recommend doing it. I recently was talking with a teenager, and I felt for both her and her mom so deeply in this, where she was saying, like, anytime she tells her mom she's upset about something, her mom will talk with her about it, and then say, "You're not going to kill yourself, are you?" And I just thought, oh man, like, I so get where this mom is coming from, right? She's reading the headlines, they have her very freaked out. But the experience of the teenager is like, what? Like, where is that coming from? Like, I just had like a day, you know? And so I really feel for parents and I really feel for teenagers, because it's important that we spotlight it, but we also have to be aware of unintended consequences of spotlighting it.
And I think also, correct me if I'm wrong, but they also like to, they'll say, "I'm just going to go kill myself." Like, they will say it to watch what you do.
What do you do when they do that?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm so glad you asked. Okay. So first of all, teenagers say, they have always said, long before the pandemic, they have always said, like, "I'm going to go kill myself. I wish I were dead. I don't want to wake up tomorrow. Like, I don't want to be
Why'd
here, right?
Why'd you have me? This Why'd is you terrible. Have me?
Yeah. Like, totally terrifying commentary. All right. Sometimes I think they do it to see, like, what are you going to do with this? I think often they do it because one of the things that's true about teenagers is they feel everything really intensely. And so when they say, like, "Oh, I feel like I could kill myself," what they're not saying, but I think what they usually mean is, like, "I am feeling so much despair," or "I am feeling so sad," or "I am feeling," and they just, like, jump to, you know, this extreme phrasing. So if your kid says anything in that department, my recommendation is that you say to them, "Listen, I heard what you said, and I have to ask, is that something you're really thinking about? Or is that you letting me know how upset you are right now?" And so often, most overwhelmingly, most of the time, kids will be like, "Oh, no, I'm not thinking about it, but I am that upset." Okay, great. You have that conversation about how upset your kid is.
Yeah.
And then if they say, "I don't know," right, then you take your kid to the emergency room and you go down that road. But usually you can just do, like, "I just got to check in. Is that you telling me how upset you are, or is that something you're really thinking about?" And that will often sort it out for you and bring it down to size.
What if we have a non-feeler, like someone who doesn't rage, doesn't, you know, go, who is all intent, looks like they're coping quite well, if we're, like, on the surface? Are we looking for these ups and downs? Like, do we want these ups and downs? But if the person is keeping themselves in a controlled state where they don't have to feel much, are we concerned about that? Like, where are we going with that one?
So that's a great question.
Tell you why, because yeah. I actually have personal experience with my daughter, who is very great, but, you know, recently she wants me to make a lot of decisions for her at 13. Mm-hmm. It seems like the consequences can be overwhelming for, you know, even should I go to soccer? I don't want to, but, and I used to praise or not. So now I'm just like, you know, I say, these are your decisions in your life, and they're not for me. They're for you. So I want you to think about what you want. And we spin. And then thankfully I had to leave the other day and she had to make her own decision and she ended up going. And before I would have been like, "I'm so proud of you." And I said nothing. I'm like, "Okay, I'll lock the door," you know, rather than making a decision. Like, I think a lot of parents do have, they think steady is sometimes good, but I'm always like trying to be like, "But, like, let's go, go out, feel, take risks." And I have to honor her comfort levels. But how can we help them if they're not showing the emotions that we think they should be? Because I do think a lot of girls especially keep life together for a very long time and don't show it as much in different ways. Do you know what I mean? I've seen it. Like, it's just sort of this thing that they hold on to.
Yeah. All right. So on the scale of, like, not at all worried to extremely worried, this would be very much on the lower end of the scale. Like, I nothing you're saying there, I'm like, "Oh, blah," you know, "you need to worry about this." Because
I think it's the secret lives of teenagers. The secret life that we get concerned about.
That, right? There's something, like, else going on. Yeah. Okay. So here's what I will say. It has not been my experience clinically that there's a big problem that suddenly gets discovered all at once. That when kids, if there's a secret life that you need to worry about, there will be signs, right? Things will be sort of falling apart at school, or they won't be able to maintain any friends, or they won't be getting up in the morning, or they will, like, it is never been my experience clinically that, like, a kid is appearing to function normally, but has a, you know, torrid, difficult, horrible circumstance of which there's no evidence, right? Like, there's typically...
I think you're more worried about them not feeling things and they can't work through it, right? Like, so I think that I've seen a lot of teenage girls who, keep it together for years. And then, you know, 15, 16, it's kind of like, I'm exhausted of pretending. And I don't know how as parents we're cracking what we've created, because, you know, for a long time, we create a lot of girls to be very, you know, and I don't know how we shake that up so we can get them to feel the emotions and mirror them and go through them.
Okay, I'll give you two strategies, because you're just going to need a strategy for this. So one, and this is so corny, but if you own it as corny and you participate in it, it really can work. And often I'm recommending this to parents of boys who say nothing, right? They can tell that there's something going on, but the kid says not a word.
Yeah, boys, it's fair.
So, you know, this is so really, I'm going to like walk it back 14 times before I say it. Doing something like roses and thorns at dinner, or best part, worst part, it works, right? Everybody has to do it. Everybody knows when they're doing it. The parents are doing it. So they're modeling, like, here was something that happened today that was really great. And here was something that happened today that was really awful. Or here's something, you know, that you just have this routinized thing. And kids can pass, right? If they don't, like, they don't have to every day, you know, do it. But it's just this kind of, we're talking about the positive, we're talking about the negative. It is part of our daily lives. There's no, you know, getting around this, right? So that's one way that can just give you something to go on. The other thing, you know, we could talk for an hour and a half about perfectionism in girls, right? That is
I think boys more and more than ever too, especially after the pandemic, you know, like especially after, you know, just this tight, buttoned up, like that's what it feels like with a lot of these children, is they are just like they're pressure cookers, and it's hard to get them to even model these emotions or feel that, you know, what your book is about, when we can't even get them to take risks to feel right now, because I feel like they're so buttoned up.
I think you're right. Okay, so here's something that can work really well to address perfectionism. When we come up against our own shortcomings, which I do like on the hour, basically, we can talk in front of our children about the shortcoming we came up against, or the mistake we made today, or the way we got it wrong, or a part of our personality that we don't like, or something we said that we wish we hadn't said. We can talk about it openly while simultaneously making it clear that we still hold ourselves at a reasonable level of self-regard, right? And it's the two together. Like, I really screwed up this meeting. I was not ready. I thought it was about one thing. It turned out it was about another thing. I felt really embarrassed, right? So saying it, but then being like, yep, won't do that again. Not the kind of mistake I usually make, you know, but like that it's not like self-flagellation and I'm so embarrassed and this is the worst thing and I feel like I'm rotten. You have to actually show both the error and the sense of like, yep, I am not perfect. I am fully human, like we all are. And having kids watch us do that for them, right? I'm both imperfect and I actually have a very high, I can still feel good about myself as a person. That goes a lot further than saying to them, but you're wonderful and you're perfect and it's not that big a mistake. Like, they can't always get past that. But modeling in that way. So those are two strategies, getting them to do roses and thorns and then owning our shortcomings while still being okay with ourselves can start to chip away at what you're describing.
Yeah. And I mean, I appreciate that so much, because one thing I think that, like I said, they watched us hold it together and kind of barely. And I feel like that's a big, but that's something that we almost passed down, is sort of like, everything is fine. We're perfect. We got this. Let's keep going 2 years.
Well, I just have to step out because my child did not get lunch ordered. So I like, my mistake. You got anything you can give me, office? Like, we don't get admitting that we do not ever sit together.
Yeah, anymore. No. And I think that what parents are struggling with is either, you know, like this modeling when, so we know in your book, you give us strategies, and I am so thankful for the strategies, because I think that's what we're all missing for ourselves. And, you know, it's new for us too, as parents, because we are, I think the permission to admit that you're, that everything's not perfect, and the permission to, you know, let them have feelings is new. Like, I really do think knowing that your teenager should actually have feelings is something that a lot of parents don't hear, because if their kid has some emotions, what's wrong with them? What have I done? Why are they like this?
No, I will say, I think my grand ambition of this book is that it brings negative feelings back into the fold. These are part of our lives. This is part of what helps kids grow. We don't have to be so scared. If you're scared, there are things you can do. Most of the time, though, these are here because your kid is a developing child. And here's how you can help them handle it. What's so strange is, in some ways, I feel like, wow, this feels so basic. Like, it feels like This doesn't deserve a book. But on the other hand, I'm like, but I don't think we're there in the culture. And I think it's really important to reassert it then.
It really is. And I think that if we could maybe go over a few of the behaviors that are normal. I remember when you told us anxiety is normal. We need anxiety to survive. That's normal. Like, what are some of the feelings that are different from adolescents to teenagers that we can expect as normal and healthy that we would be scared of before your book?
Okay. So I love talking with you. You just ask me all the questions I'm dying to answer. So one is, they don't like school. Like, very rarely is a teenager like, I love all my classes and my teachers and the homework. I mean, like, they do not. They do not. And I think somehow we sort of get this idea that, like, something's wrong. Like, they, like, why don't they like all of this? So one of the things I lay out in the book is a metaphor that I came up with. And you know how I feel about metaphors. Like, I love my metaphors. That we need to recognize that school is like a buffet where teenagers are required to eat everything, right? You and I go up to the buffet. I'm like, I'll have a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I'm out, right? And with teenagers, we're like, eat it all. Eat it all.
And like it.
And like it, right? We don't have to ask that they like it. And as soon as you move it into this idea of, like, right, food preferences, like, we all have them. What I like about this metaphor is that it neutralizes it, right? You're not going to like every subject. You're not going to like the way each teacher serves every subject. Mm-hmm. This is not a comment on your character. This is not a comment on your shortcomings. This actually doesn't also mean that you won't like it later, right? Right? There's stuff that you don't like at one age and you like it later. Maybe the same is true for a subject. It also doesn't mean they shouldn't be asked to try it all. Like, I actually think there's no problem with having them be like, you got to try the whole buffet. But if we move into this food preference mode, the conversations get a lot easier, right? Because the first thing we can say is like, well, of course you don't like it all because you didn't choose it all. Like, we're not upset that you don't like it. You don't need to be upset that you don't like it. That's the nature of school. Already, so much grief and anxiety has just been sent away. And then we can say, like, what would make this easier to eat, right? Like, if you don't like the way it's being served in class, do you want to see if we can find a YouTube video of a teacher who does serve it up in a way that is more palatable to you?
Oh, or
do you want me to sit next to you while you eat the last of this? Because, like, sometimes that's how we get through it, right? Or do you, like, can you take smaller bites? Or how much of it do you have to eat, right? So if you don't even like the subject, don't fill your plate. Like, eat as much as you need just to get the mastery or the grade you're looking for or both. But don't go past that point. But as soon as we move into this, like, I mean, admittedly somewhat strange food preference model, all of the sense of, like, who's messing this up goes away. And I think that that is an unnecessary and unhelpful contributor to a lot of anxieties about school.
When you're giving them permission not to like everything, that right away would make them sigh. Like, they wouldn't be like, what's wrong with me? I'm not doing well at this. Of course you're not. You don't like it. Like, that makes sense. You know, I can't sit in my plate. I don't like it. Of course. Yep. So that is huge sigh of relief, I think, for children, teenagers, and adults. That expectation is, of course you're not going to like everything and be great at everything. That's impossible.
Yeah. And we're going to still ask you to eat some of it because you are 15 and we're not going to give up on it yet. But
right.
We're not going to make you feel bad about the fact that you're kind of, like, choking it down.
Cool. I love the permission to let go of that feeling. And are there any other ones that are different than the grade two who's like, I love, like, you know, what are those?
Well, so another thing that is really, I mean, you know, I love teenagers. And, like, one of the things we don't talk about enough, like, we talk about the fact that they feel things intensely, right? We've already said that they feel things, negative things intensely. The truth is they also feel positive things more intensely than we do or than little kids do. Like every feeling they have is on steroids.
Lucky them.
I know. Well, so this is something we need to harness sometimes, because when they're upset, comforts that don't look like much to us actually are very powerful for them. And I'll give you an example. So I have a daughter who, she's now, you know, my college age student. She was a high schooler during the pandemic. You know, we were all miserable through the pandemic. And every once in a while, she'd say like, I need to go vibe. And then she would get a cup of tea and a candle, and she would sit there with her music, and she would be like blissful. And I would look at her like, oh man, I am so jealous. Like I could do all that and I would still hate the pandemic every bit as much. But because she has these fabulously powerful adolescent emotions, when she does things that like look kind of trivial from the outside, they're really powerful. And so as we think about that chapter 5 I mentioned of like helping kids get feelings back under control or getting some relief, do not count out things that they do, like come home and roll around on the floor with a dog, or go for a run if it feels good for them, or take a long bath, or watch like a TV show that they have seen a billion times, but they watch it again, it makes them happy. It works for them more than it would work for us. And we have to really honor and actually support that.
You know, it's funny. My daughter wakes up. She doesn't have to go to school till 10 o'clock, but she likes to wake up at 7 when everyone wakes up, because her morning routine of getting herself ready and having all her little products and all of that is just, I just know she loves it. And my husband is like, what is she doing in there? Like she wakes up so early, it takes so long. And I'm like, doesn't bother me. I know that's how she prepares for her day. It's part of her thing. And I know she enjoys it because she wakes up early to do it. And like, it's exactly like that's part of just her ritual to do that makes her feel good. I'm like, let her do the thing. Who cares?
Yep. It feels, we like that kind of thing. They love that kind of thing, right? And that's the thing we have to really honor.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously we'll touch upon anxiety. Is anxiety a lot higher for teenagers versus adolescents at a normal rate, if you will?
Like, and is it, especially now, is it different than if you had a teenager who was a teenager but is older now, and then you've got a teenager now? Are we dealing with different levels of anxiety there?
So anxiety is higher among teenagers than it used to be. And so we can do like why it was higher pre-pandemic, because we were already seeing it rise before the pandemic.
Okay.
And this is all with the big, you already said it, like most anxiety is normal, healthy. It alerts us to threats. Yeah. You're supposed to be anxious when something's wrong. Like that's fine. What we're concerned about is anxiety that is persistent and prevalent and doesn't make any sense or is way too big for whatever is going on. So we were seeing higher anxiety among teenagers. And again, like it's hard to pathologize this pre-pandemic because of things like climate change, guns, political strife. That when the APA, the American Psychological Association, did a fantastic survey asking, and like young people are like, I'm pretty freaked out about this stuff, right? Yeah. And so again, though, like not for no reason. Right. So it's one of those delicate things of like, I don't want to say like there's something wrong with them that they're anxious. Like these are very much warranted concerns. Right. So I don't like that they have these higher level of concerns, but we have been seeing those. Then came the pandemic, and two things happened that I think took anxiety up another level for a lot of kids. One is like it rocked our world. Right. I mean, I think all of us, like we were living one day on March 12th and we were living another way on March 13th. And like none of us had ever seen anything like that. And I think a lot of people still have this kind of jarring sense of like, you know, that's scary.
Just it's like you lost trust in the world that anything could just be taken from you at any time.
I think of her little boy and the teachers went on strike and they weren't going to school. And he's like this, is everything canceled? Like, am I done? Is everything gone and done? Like right away, he was like, do I have hockey anymore? Like, because school wasn't on, the world was done again. And I would like, that is your narrative.
No, they'll always feel, oh,
yeah, you're afraid that everything will be gone again. You know, so interesting. And he was like 6 or 5 when it started. So that is that little person. You can imagine the teenagers, their life getting ripped away from them right when they were just getting into it.
It's hard to trust again. I mean, we don't know if it can happen again.
Yeah. So like, there's that, like, none of us have had that experience before of like, the world can change literally in 24 hours. And I think that changed all of us. The other thing is that one of the fundamental rules in psychology is that avoidance feeds anxiety. That when we are scared of something, if we stay away from it, the outcome down the line is we actually become more anxious. All right. So here I am sitting here as a psychologist in March, April, 2020. And already I'm thinking, uh-oh, all of this avoidance that is being mandated for very, very good medical reasons, right? We don't go to school. We don't leave the house. We don't go to the grocery store. We don't go anywhere. Everything is scary. We just stay home. We avoid it all. I was like, I'm 100% behind the medical rationale for this. This is going to be a huge problem down the line. Because here's how avoidance and anxiety become friends, which is, let's say I'm thinking about going to the grocery store. Let's say I'm a kid. Let's say I'm a teenager, right? And I'm thinking about going to a party and I'm anxious about it. Like, am I going to know people? Are people going to talk to me? Am I going to feel, you know, connected, or am I going to feel isolated? And so I get really anxious as the time of the party is getting close. And then I think, I'll just say I was busy. And so I cancel. So I avoid. Two things happen. First, my anxiety drains away. I feel so much better instantly. So we call this like a reinforcing experience. The second thing that happens is whatever I imagined was so scary about that party is like, it's sealed in amber, right? It goes unchallenged. Like, I believe that to be true because I didn't show up at the party and realize like, oh, there's my friend. And oh, this isn't that big a deal. So every time we avoid something that makes us anxious, we actually have an accelerating sense of anxiety. Like, it still feels scary. Avoidance feels great. And so one of the things we are seeing, which we have never seen at this level, is kids not going to school now. Schools across the board are dealing with truancy or school refusal at rates that have never been seen before, because kids are like, I don't know, school makes me uncomfortable, I'm not going. Because they got so used to that idea that avoidance is effective, but it entrenches itself.
When they're not going to school, that means they're also not going online school. They're just skipping school.
They're just like disengaged. Yeah. They're skipping school. And then they're also missing all the peer stuff, all the social stuff, all the, like, the entire environment that is being in school. So our solution is we help kids wade back in. We don't say like, you got to go to school all day, every day, you know, full stop. We say, go to your first period. See if you can get through first period. And if you can get through first period and that's as much as you can do, I'll come get you, right? Now, tomorrow, let's try to do first and second period. So like, we know how to treat this. And the way we treat it, we call it exposure, graduated exposure, like you wade back in. It's hard. It is the only solution, and it's a really effective solution.
What takes so much effort from parents and patients to just be like, not be like, don't fucking
stop. And I'm assuming that's with fourth, and I'm assuming that's with extracurricular, and I'm assuming that's with, like, I'm assuming that's everything. That's not just
everything.
It's like the kids were like, I hate it, I don't want to do it, but they, you know, they love it. It's just getting them there for a little bit, you know, all summer. So you get them in, so they try it, and then, but that is an outcome of what we're dealing with, which I don't think parents know. They just think, what's wrong with my child? But what we're saying is they learned how to avoid for so long, and anxiety came with avoidance. It's like they became afraid to leave the house. Like, it was so comfortable in the house. Now leaving is like, I don't want to feel that feeling.
But like you're saying, it's so effective to do it slowly is.
Well, so the world doesn't like that, because the world likes it now 100%. And
so that's so much work for for working parents to just be like, I can't deal with this, but it's going to be the only effective way that you're going to get them back. It's so hard.
It is so hard. It is so hard. And I hate, as a parent myself, giving advice that I'm like, this is going to be really hard to make happen. But I have said to parents, you driving your kid and sitting in the school parking lot with your kid is better than your kid being home with you. Right? Wow. Like, who has that kind of time? But like, I promise you, and the thing is, I'm basing this on science that we have had fully established. There's zero controversy. Like, we know exactly, we call it like often treating phobias. Like, we know exactly what works. We are just dealing with it at scale and, you know, urgency. I mean, for a teenager to not go to school can just do so much to narrow their world. And like, it's so the opposite of what we normally would want to see for teenagers.
Wow. I mean, Lisa DeMore, my gosh, you just bring so much to the table that I think normalizes this journey where it can seem really hard and really overwhelming and really scary. And I just, you know, we all can take a deep breath listening to this and knowing that number one, there's solutions. Number two, normal. There are strategies. And number three, when we talk and normalize some of these behaviors that are not quote unquote normal, but are more normal now for us as parents, I think it helps us get back, not in control because we can't control parenting, but more with strategies we all feel better about
and a better understanding of what's actually happening.
Well, I'm so glad.
Can I come back and do Mean Girl Phenomena?
Yeah, we will come back and do Mean Girl Phenomena. I'm really sorry about that.
No. I love talking about the book. But I was really excited for that topic too. So we'll look to get
anytime. I would talk to you guys all day. The book comes out. Yeah.
Where can everybody find you?
So where to find me? I'm on Instagram at lisa.damour, lisa.damour. I'm on Facebook, Lisa Damour PhD. I have a website, drlisadamour.com. I have a podcast. Thanks to your loving support, you were such incredible advocates at the beginning, called Ask Lisa, The Psychology of Parenting. Every week we answer a parenting question. And then the book publishes, it's called The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, on February 21st. It's available for
a special book ahead of that.
Oh yeah, you did. It's available for pre-order, but people can pre-order it now. And then if they pre-order it now, it'll arrive right to their homes on February 21st.
Oh, they should pre-order it now. And then when will the audio be out too?
So the book comes out on February 21st and the audio does also. I just finished recording it. Yeah.
If you're going away for any spring breaks, download all of Lisa Damour's books and listen to them on the plane, because if you have plane anxiety, I don't. But if you do, listening to you during takeoff and landing is like the most calming, soothing, and then helpful on top of that ever. So really, yeah, I am just so thankful that you are here. And yes, we will do Mean Girl Phenomenon. I just got into the emotions of the teenager because I really do think that it's something none of us are talking about. That is really
Mean Girl.
What? No, also the emotions, like of what's normal now and why it's changed. You know, like that we should expect changes and that's okay, because you might have had a teenager 6 years ago and that's different than now, and you can't compare.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I'd love to come back.
Yes, please. I need to talk about the Mean Girl Phenomenon. Everyone's talking about it. Nobody knows what's happening. Got to come back.
Okay. Thank you. Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. You too. Thank you. Bye.